The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 711 for Monday, May 28th, 2018. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show that takes your tips, your questions, your cool stuff found, all sorts of information that we find throughout the week. We assemble it, we present it, we mix it all together to make it fun and entertaining and informative, with the goal being that each and every one of us learns at least five new things every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Otherworld Computing, where you can check out their new Envoy Pro EX with Thunderbolt 3, and Crossover from Codeweavers. If you're holding a grudge, it's time to rejudge, and we will talk more about Crossover and OWC in a minute. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, wishing I could be driving 7-Eleven, this is John F. Braun.
Yeah, there was an old car, stock car races right near us that where we grew up, where there was a guy named Don LaJoy who drove the 7-Eleven car. We'll put a picture of his car in the show image for today for all of you to enjoy.
Yeah, and then they knocked it down and they put them all there.
They knocked down the racetrack. They didn't knock down Don.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
That'd be rude.
That'd be really rude. Yeah. Yeah, he used to live right around the corner from me, and so we would, I think the races were on Saturdays, or maybe they were on Sundays. I want to say they were on Sundays, but whatever it was, the day after the races, you could sort of drive by his house and see the carnage, but you know, that's just how it goes. All right, let's get into some quick tips here. The first one that I want to share is one that happened to actually me and you, John. Jeff at Backbeat got a new contract in, sent me the contract, went into mail, typed in Dave Hamilton, and mail auto-filled my address as it always does, and then sent it. But for whatever reason, it went to our feedback at MacGeekGab.com address. Now, that's the address.
I think I heard you right. You said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
I think for the first time. I know. Yeah, but you're right. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com was where it went. So John wound up getting it. And it was like, okay. Like, I mean, John and I wound up getting it, right? And I saw it come in. It was like, ooh, okay. So I realized what had happened was that on Jeff's computer, his previous recipients – what do you call it? Database, perhaps, in mail, somehow at some point in time had associated my name with that email address. And so so I had him go and fix that. And you can manage that too. If you go into mail and you go to window and then go to previous recipients, you will get this whole list and it's searchable. There's a little search field there. You can narrow it down. And if you delete something from there, it will delete it from that autofill list. So this is one place where mail builds its autofill list. It also builds it from your contacts. So if there's something incorrect in your contacts, well, that you go and solve in contacts. But this tries to be smart about people that aren't in your contacts to make life easier for sending emails back to them and that sort of thing. So check that out. Go to mail and then go to the window menu and choose previous recipients. And you can potentially, avoid potential embarrassment or worse, right? Thankfully, in this case, it wasn't a big deal. It was just John and me and no big deal. But yeah, could have been worse. So there you go. That's quick tip number one. Do you manage that stuff actively, John, or do you only deal with it when you have to?
I can't remember the last time I've had a mix-up due to the contents of that database. But I remember you had – there was another time where I think it was you were sending things from your iDevice.
Yeah.
It was coming from
– something was happening. Oh, yeah, perhaps. Yeah, invariably, this problem was caused by me, right? At some point in time, I sent an email – that was from my name and from that address, and somehow that auto populated, you know, Jeff's previous recipient's database for sure. Yep. Yep. And I think this was probably a holdover from that, John. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Cool. Hey, so Andrew chimes in here and he says, I use Siri on my Mac in macOS 10.12.6 all the time for general queries. Then one day for kicks, I asked for information about the computer. I asked about the serial number, the processor type, the macOS version, how much RAM I had, the hard drive capacity, and a multitude of other system-related information, which was spoken immediately. He says, this was surprising, although I don't know why it should be, since Siri on the Mac has proven to be super useful. I will continue to see what else I can accomplish using Siri in macOS. I always forget that Siri is there in macOS, but it's there. And like, this is super helpful. I tried to ask it on my iPhone, the serial number, no go, only on the Mac. But yeah, there you go.
Weird.
What's that?
That's kind of weird.
Yeah. I don't know why. I mean, I can go in and get it out of, you know, settings general on or settings general about, I guess, on iOS. But yeah, I don't know why. Like, yeah, anyway, but that's how it is. So quick tips, you know, that's what we do. It's a good one. I like it. Do you use Siri on the Mac at all, John?
Nope.
Perhaps that will change.
Maybe. I've just, I don't know. I don't know why I don't really use her that much. The only assistant I use is, that other one.
Yeah, the A-Lady, right? Yeah. All right, cool. Hey, on the iPhone, Lawyer Jeff actually had two quick tips for us from on Twitter. And the first is a reminder that on the iPhone X, you will see there's a little bar along the bottom of the screen. And that's sort of the replacement or placeholder, or I don't know what you'd call it. It's the avatar for the home button, right? And that's where you would swipe up and you know, do things that you would previously do with the home button. Well, if you just swipe right with that bar, you can use it to switch apps, swipe right or left. So it's sort of hard to describe, but trust me when I say that it works. That bar's there and you just swipe and there go the apps. Switch from one to the other real easy. You don't need to like do any weird little shapes with your finger. You just back and forth. It's pretty cool. I like it. Thanks for the reminder, Jeff. Very, very good. And while we are at it, he reminds us on the Mac about option clicking in the notification center icon to snooze it. And in fact, I usually do this when I start podcasting so that I don't get distracted with notifications sort of flooding in. And the really nice part about it is when you do this, when you option click on that, it snoozes it. And then of course, option clicking again would unsnooze it, but it is a snooze. It is not a mute. In that it only does it for 24 hours. So if you forget, 24 hours later, it turns back on anyway. And you can do this. Of course, now there's something wrong with my Mac. I can't click on Notification Center. But, oh, there it is. If you click on Notification Center, and it's weird, but scroll up. Like, so it'll start with the today on your notifications and then list them down from there. If you scroll up from that, you'll see hidden above is a switch for do not disturb. And it's the same thing. And it'll say do not disturb. And once you turn it on, it'll say we'll turn off tomorrow. Pretty cool, huh, John?
That is a good one. It doesn't look like there's any way to set the amount of time.
No. I wonder if there's like a defaults setting from the terminal you could do. Yeah.
Well, that is a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially for those that are easily distracted. I should, I just clicked on it.
Mm-hmm. It's a good thing to do while podcasting. I find, you know, my family, we have a family text group that we use to communicate. And sometimes when I'm at my desk, you know, in the middle of the day, someone will say something and then, you know, two or three of them will just start texting back and forth with each other. And it's like, oh, my God, like everything I own starts blowing up while I'm trying to get work done. So in those moments, I flip my phone over onto its face, so I don't see it. I have to, if I'm wearing my Apple Watch that day, I have to take it off, because otherwise, whoa. And then on the Mac, I just option click that thing, and then I can get back into whatever it was I was doing. So yeah, it's handy. Handy. All right, John, shall we move on to some cool stuff found here for the week?
Sure.
All right, cool. Greg brings us one. It says, a bit of cool stuff found is Horcrux email backup. It's a utility I came across a few weeks ago that I really like. It's a menu bar app that runs in the background and saves a backup of your email files to your Mac's internal storage drive. This makes it easy to migrate to a new email service if needed at any point. And the best part is that it runs automatically in the background on a schedule of your choosing. It has replaced Mail Steward for my email backup needs. I might be slightly paranoid about this, but if something happens to any of the email services I use, I want to know that I have a copy of all my emails that have already been downloaded and it's not server dependent. Two thumbs up for this app so far. And it's in the Mac App Store. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, but it's $20. And it says that it works. It lets you automatically back up your mail from any IMAP supported email account with great ease. So that's, I have not tried Horcrux yet, but, I like the idea of this because email is kind of important. And with the way IMAP works, you know, the server is the master. So if something happens, even on one of your devices that causes, you know, one device to push a bunch of deletion commands to the server, those will be reflected down onto all your other devices. Now, of course, if you have a backup of your Mac, you might be able to restore from that. But doing something like this makes life a little better. So cool. Thank you for that. Good one. Yeah. Good, John.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a light. It's a lighter version. Because, yeah, as mentioned, Mail Steward is, they have different levels of product. And
Mail Steward.
They may do more than you need.
Yeah. And I've tried Mail. I should try Mail Steward again. It always felt heavy. So I like your description of Horcrux being light. And if Horcrux is doing this sort of in the background all the time, it too might feel heavy, right? We haven't tried it, but I like the concept. So cool. Good stuff. All right. We'll put a link to Mail Steward there in the show notes too. All right. Jumping on to Jeff with cool stuff found. He says in the last episode, 710, you guys were wondering about the charging wattage of an Apple small iPhone charger versus a Qi charger, and which one was working when both Qi and wired were connected to an iPhone. He says, I highly recommend listeners add a PortaPow power monitor to their toolkit. This has been a fantastic $12 tool that I frequently use to evaluate chargers cables and diagnose most charging issues. The device is placed between the charging brick and the charging cable and shows the charging brick's voltage, current, and power. He says, I have the version 2 device, but the new version 3 device is even better. It has the same capabilities, but also adds a data condom feature where it can sit in between you and, say, the USB port in the wall of your coffee house where you don't know if it's providing just power or perhaps someone is trying to take over your data. He says, so this would prevent that, which I like that concept. Yeah. And so we've talked about these before. This is, it's an inline USB power monitor or power meter, I guess is the right thing to say. And it does. It's got, this one's got a little, you know, I guess LCD display and shows you, you know, what's going on. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Very, very, very cool. I like it. It's, and for $12, that's the right place, right price. We've talked about other things like this in the past, but
you and I have. Oh, I got a. It seems there's like one company that makes them for everybody, or like two companies.
Yeah, right.
Because you got one that I got a generic version of one that you had a brand name version of, and they were exactly the same, except that the one that I bought cost like half of what you paid.
I think it was a third. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But And the reason we need this is because it's so difficult to get iOS to tell you this information.
iOS doesn't tell you this information. It tells you different information. It tells.
Well, I've seen it try, but it's usually a hack.
What iOS tells you is what the maximum capability of the of the connected charger is, but it does not tell you the current. Like it in the no pun intended. Funny. Yeah, the in the moment power draw, because it changes as you're charging, right? And won't go full tilt if you're just at, like, you know, if you have 5% left, 5% left to charge, rather. So it's handy using one of these things. I use it all the time to test out, you know, somebody sends us a new battery and things like that to check out. Which reminds me, I have a ton, I'm guessing you do too, of cool stuff found that I've checked out that we need to add to the list. So we'll do that shortly. All right. Greg reminds us, but I don't know if we've actually talked about this, but listener Greg adds to cool stuff found the Seagate Iron Wolf drives. He says, have you heard about them? It seems that there are a lot of benefits for using them with a Synology NAS. And Greg is right. I actually have one of my test units has a couple of Iron Wolf drives in it. And they are, I guess the best way that I would describe this, John, you've heard about this from Synology too, but the best way I would describe it is that it takes the concept and sort of the idea of what smart was supposed to do, where a drive reports its own health and sort of negotiates with the bus about that, and takes it to a level where it actually is doing that, right? I mean, and it's testing things, all kinds of different things, including, you know, bad blocks and all those things. But it's also looking for rotational vibrations and reporting back, like if you've had an event where the drive's been hit, or if it's tilted on its side or something that's going to cause it to run either non-optimally or potentially impact its life cycle, like all of these things, and including power management and all that other stuff. Did I get that close to right, John?
Yeah, I think that's most of the extra. And they also just in general claim that it's NAS optimized.
Right.
They're meant for, you could certainly use them not in a NAS, but if they're in a NAS, then you get all these bonus features, and you even get a special control panel.
Yeah, you do. Right. Synology's show you a special, or the disk station.
And
shows
you get it. And the thing is, I thought I did get some that they had hooked me up with some pre Iron Wolf ones.
Okay.
Like, oh, where's the special icon and all this stuff there? And then you're like, oh, I see it.
Right. Right.
I don't know if you recall off the top of your head additional stuff it shows you.
I'm looking at it. I mean, it does tests, and I mean, it doesn't show you much if there's much extra if there's nothing wrong, but it is showing me the temperature of the drive, the power on time, so how many hours it's actually been running, the disk reconnection count, the bad sector count. And then it also shows smart status, which thankfully for the drive I'm looking at is normal, and Iron Wolf health status, which also is showing as normal. So, and I just ran a test here while we were talking, and not on my computer. I mean, it's just a web interface, so I figured that was safe to do.
But wait, there's more.
Go ahead.
Is that they also have, well, if you get what they call their Iron Wolf Pro, it comes with 2 years of data recovery service. Isn't that neat?
Oh. Huh. Yeah. Smart.
So it's so they offer a lot of stuff. So that's certainly something I think would appeal to NAS users.
Yeah, for sure. Huh. Very interesting.
So cool. You probably pay a couple of bucks extra for all these great additional features, but
that's sort of the point, yeah. Is you're actually getting something. Yeah. Cool. Okay, so we've had two from Greg, and now two different Gregs, by the way, and now I will bring in our second cool stuff found from a Jeff, although it's a different Jeff, and this is let's see, where are we here? He says, your recent DVR discussion led me to thinking of my new solution. He says, I cut the cord this month with using an antenna now, and I have found that the Tablo, T-A-B-L-O DVR, works very well as a solution. It's a DVR that has to be connected to an antenna and my network via Ethernet. I then hang a 4 gig Western Digital hard drive from it, and it is viewable through apps on my smart TV and Apple TV or Roku or its own iOS app. He says it works at home or away from home, and he says, so far, I'm really pleased. He says it's not quite as slick as the X1 or TiVo, but for us cord cutters, he says, it's pretty great. So we will put that in the show notes. Yeah, I don't know how much longer the cable companies are going to get away with what they their current business model. At least, part of their business model is selling internet access. I think that will definitely continue at least until 5G really takes off, and then maybe that'll give them a run for their money. But in terms of you must buy, hundreds of dollars worth of content, most of which you're not going to view every month, is something that I'm not convinced is going to last. Thoughts, John? I didn't mean
that. No, I think it will, because they're the only game in town. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing, is they're not the only game in town, right? Like, the last thing they want, like when you call them up and say, hey, I'm not happy with my bill, notice what has changed. It used to be that they would say, okay, well, we can lower your bill, but we have to also lower, the amount of services you get. Now what they do is they say, okay, yep, we'll lower your bill, whatever, $20 or $30 a month. And we'll throw in on top of, you'll maintain your same service level, plus we'll throw in 6 months of Showtime or something like that, right? Because what they don't want you to do is you to say, okay, fine, yeah, lower my bill by $30 a month, and yeah, I get less. And then you're sitting there on your couch thinking, oh, I really wanted that thing on whatever, HBO. And you're like, you know what? I could just buy that direct from HBO, either a la carte, or I could pay this service, or whatever it is. They do not want you to open that door even one little inch, because they know that when you start, like if you're willing to do the sort of deal with the concept of app-based or individual purchases for your content, the cable companies lose. And so they don't want, they don't even want you to consider that. They don't want to provide the opportunity for you to even begin to head down that path. Because most of us are, not all, and I'm actually in the not all category here, but many of us are in areas where you can get decent coverage from an HD antenna, and those aren't that expensive at all. So it's very interesting.
You know, I may pick one up.
Yeah,
I've seen some at my local BJ's, is our local warehouse store. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they have them otherwise. But you got to check, though. But I think there is a service online where you can see how many miles away you are from people that broadcast HD.
Yeah.
Free HD TV.
I'm trying to think of it off the top of my head. Because Plex will link with all of this, right? Is you get the whole Plex TV thing, and then you can link your, you could do the, what is it, the HD home run thing, is that right? You can link that with Plex and do all this. So yeah, there's from Silicon Dust. So I'm doing this as we're talking here, so it'll be a little bit herky jerky, but you can, so the HD home run would be similar in a sense to this Tablo thing, where it's the thing that receives your channels. And I'm looking to see, I think on their website, they had a link to what was available. I can't find it. Yeah. We'll find it. We'll put a link in the show notes to, there you go. Their channels page. Right. So I think AntennaWeb is
yes.
one place
yeah, I just tried that.
Where you can go. Okay, cool. And you put in your zip code.
Yeah, so I put in my zip code, and then it shows me I can get ABC and Independent, PBS. Wow. Yeah, I should get one of those, even though it's probably mostly redundant with when I got on cable.
Well, but that's the thing. Then then you can turn off cable, right? And then save a bunch of money because HDTV is broadcast for free. But yeah, see, I have I've only got two channels that I could potentially receive here, and one of them is like, you know, likely to be not great. So I'm not in the right place, unfortunately, which kind of sucks. But anyway, you can check it out. I will put a link to Silicon Dust's page because they link to a lot of these resources, AntennaWeb, the FCC, and TV Fool for the U.S. And then there's different ones for different markets, including Canada, Australia, and throughout Europe. So I will link to their page so that you can find the one that works for you. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, it's interesting stuff for sure. I don't know. It's cool. So yeah, where you are, John, you might be able to cut the cord very easily and still get over the air stuff. Although you probably, I mean, really it's sports, right? And even the sports, umbrella, like the general description of sports is not accurate because if you're into anything but football, most of that now you can get, via an app, MLB and NHL and all that stuff. Whereas football, they're the ones that are sort of shackled to the networks because of all their exclusivity contracts here in the USA. But I think that'll go away. I mean, very clearly, I think that'll go away. So, yeah, it's interesting. All right. Shall we get back on track with Cool Stuff Found, John, or do you have more to say on that?
No, we're good.
All right, cool. Off to Joe, then. And Joe says, I wanted to comment on your segment about encrypted email. Proton mail, of course, would be great, but there's another great option to fit this use case of not wanting the recipient to have to be burdened with another platform / account. I wanted to lobby for a mention of Virtru at VIRTRU, a slick product for encrypting email and or files. And in my opinion, perhaps one of the nicest ways of sending encrypted content to someone outside of your organization. Their iOS app is free, and there's a link, and there's, I think, a fair amount of free use options with it, certainly for the occasional use case. Since it was initially for Gmail and Google Drive, unfortunately not yet compatible directly with Apple's mail, but they've introduced an iOS client, so you can use it that way. Encryption decryption occurs on the device, so there's no opportunity for Virtru to ever have access to the contents, which is what makes it HIPAA compliant. He says HIPAA compliance advertisement, FYI, can be an easy way to see if the vendor is staying out of the business of having access to your data, being that it is still encrypted at rest. That's a nice little litmus test. I had not thought of HIPAA compliance as something that indicates that, but it certainly does. He says, here's the Virtru distinction. He says, I know the fellow posing the question in the previous episode didn't want to mess with apps. He says, I presume he meant more for the recipient. That's right. He says, but the iOS app is free. And the cool part is the recipient doesn't have to set up an account with Virtru. They use a very slick way of using email for the federation part of identifying the recipient. Then from the email, you can go through Virtru's cloud to initiate decryption. So very cool. We will, they're Virtru. It's kind of in a way, it's kind of like iMessage in that there's, you know, device specific keys. It looks like happening here, but we'll put a link to Virtru and you folks can check it out too. But thank you, Joe. That's a good one for sure. So thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, I'll have to look. They say easy end-to-end encryption, so
right.
I'll believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
They also mentioned that they comply with some other crypto standards here. What is it?
Yeah.
I'll check it out later.
Cool. All right, cool. This brings up an interesting point, though, that's sort of been swimming around for a couple of weeks, and we've gotten actually quite a few emails about. The EFF posted a piece back, about 2 weeks ago, about something that's called e-fail and the PGP flaw, as they call it, where a group of researchers published a paper that describes a way that encrypted email could be hacked isn't the right word. What would you call this, John? But essentially, it creates a scenario where the email that you thought was encrypted end to end still is encrypted end to end, but there's a way of tricking one end or the other into decrypting it and displaying it. Is that?
Yeah, because we got a, and actually our good friend Dr. Bob actually sent an article to us, which I think wasn't very good. It was, I think, a USA Today piece, because they actually said in this piece, they're like, well, oh, this is an exploit that decrypts it. And it's like, no. What it is that it's I guess you call it an injection attack, from what I can tell, is that you basically put some HTML similar to like what a web bug does.
Okay.
And that, because email clients can render HTML, if you put certain HTML in the email, you can trick the client into sending it. So it's not really decrypting it. So it's kind of phishing, I guess you could say.
Okay. Yeah.
The only thing that they bring up in, and I sent him some better write-ups that go into this, and
we'll put a link to the EFF's write-up, which is pretty clear on it all too. Yep.
Yeah. The thing you got to keep in mind is that in order to do this, and this is what I like, I think it was the Wired write-up, and they're like, getting a level of access where you can intercept and modify someone's encrypted email is not trivial.
Right. That's true. You need access to their computer, right?
I mean, and I think the other thing that I saw that was brought up is that if they put additional stuff to kind of redirect or trick your email client, you're probably going to get a signature failure because they've modified the payload. So,
oh, interesting. Right. Right.
But as they also said in the one that I saw, they're like, but you know, most people, including us sometimes, I mean, we get them sometimes with I'll get a thing with a signature failure and I'm just like,
yeah, you ignore it. You overlook it. It's true. No, that's totally true. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, be aware of this, but it's not quite as bad as some. It's not the attack some places are making it seem, but it is possible. So, you know, be aware, be mindful of who has access to your computer, because really that's where it is, right? That's where the keys are stored, is on your device. So that, I would say, that's where you need to protect the most. Am I right about saying that, John?
For this, I mean, it's not really I don't think really, the exploit really doesn't have anything to do with keys.
But that's what I'm saying, is it's your device that's decrypting it. It can't be decrypted by someone else, right? So you're decrypting it, and then this phishing attack essentially tricks your computer into exposing the contents in a way that could be read with like JavaScript or something else like that. Is that? Or maybe not JavaScript, but some other,
as far as I know,
some other engine running on. So it's almost not malware, but in that sense. Yeah. So it's instead of a man in the middle attack, would it be best to call it a man looking over your shoulder attack? Right. Where your computer displays this information and you don't realize what else is able to see it when it does.
I like that.
It's the man looking over your shoulder attack. Okay.
Well, you know, I just, I'm trying to think. I heard of a recent study where someone came up with a conclusion that most data leaks are from people doing exactly that.
Right.
It's not, you know, hackers with, you know, like massive, you know, computing abilities or, you know, mad hacker skills that are, you know, stealing your data. It's the guy on the subway that's looking over your shoulder.
Yeah. All right, well, we've coined a new phrase now, John. The man look, or it, we may not be the first to coin this phrase, but we've certainly coined a new phrase. The man looking over your shoulder.
I mean, I had that happen once. I was on the train, yeah. And apparently the guy ahead of me, the guy who was sitting in front of me, apparently worked for the DOD, or at least that's what the seal on the top of the documents he was looking at said. And I'm like,
Yeah, I've always wondered about that on airplanes, man. Like, when someone is viewing something that is confidential, having it say confidential in, like, bold, bright letters is the thing that makes me decide I want to read what he's got, right? Like, that's what stimulates curiosity. If the dude's just there messing around on his laptop with, you know, some boring PowerPoint presentation, which, by the way, is boring because it doesn't say confidential all over it, then it's like I could care less what the guy's doing. But it's when, you know, it has these like it's, do not or like you said, you know, has the big DOD seal on it. Like, yeah, guys, that's an announcement, not smart. So if you want to send something that is truly sensitive, you know, Times New Roman 12 with nothing about confidentiality on it. I mean, obviously, when you deliver it to the recipient, well, then for sure, make sure that person understands the sensitivity of the information you're giving them. But otherwise, do not plaster all over the document itself that this is highly confidential. I realize that there are things like there's legal reasons where you would want to have this is confidential, this is confidential, this is confidential, because otherwise, you know, the opposing parties or whatever could say, ah, but you didn't say so, therefore. But anyway, yeah. Hey, twice in one episode, we will mention Jeff Q here at Backbeat Media. He contributed a cool stuff found this week, too. And it's both a Mac app and service and iOS app and even a watch app called Strides, Strides. And then it's at stridesapp.com. And it's a habit tracker or goal tracker. Where, you know, if you want to do something every day, right? You know, you want to get, I don't know, go for a walk or get to the gym or anything, you know, you can set these habits and it reminds you and rewards you and that sort of thing. And then you can also set goals like, you know, I want to, you know, get to a certain weight or I want to save a certain amount or whatever. And he you know, it's one of these sort of mindfulness apps, not a meditation app, but you know, reminding you of staying on track and sort of focusing you. And Jeff is someone that is very, very mindful anyway in his life. So anytime he recommends an app to me that sort of would guide that he says he uses that would guide him down that path, it means that that recommendation carries a heavy weight. So I wanted to share that along, and this looks fantastic. I haven't tried it out yet, but really kind of helps, you know, helps with motivation and inspiration and all that stuff. So stridesapp.com, and it's a freemium thing where you can sign up and use it in a certain sense for free and then move on past that. So there you go. Good. Yeah. Yes. John, any thoughts? Cool. And lastly, in the cool stuff found scenario here, Jason on Twitter recommended something called Relaunch Alfred. Now, it's R-E-L-O-N-C-H is the name of the company, Relaunch Inc. And Alfred is it's a photos app, but it's got AI in it that imitates artificial light based on different adjustment maps. So it sort of looks at the picture, decides what pieces of it should be lit in different ways, and then lights them differently for you. And you can go check it out. It's kind of a proof of, it feels like this is a proof of concept of the way their AI works. And my guess is, you know, we will see more from them along these lines. But for now, you can go and download Alfred from it's Relaunch Alfred, R-E-L-O-N-C-H Alfred, in the App Store, and it is free, which is, of course, we really like. So that's cool stuff. Did you check this one out yet, John?
I mean, they got a demo on their page where you move the slider and
yeah
I don't know, it looks like it's changing
Yeah, I mean, it's adjusting backlight and front lighting and all of that stuff. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah,
I mean, a lot of this you can do with usually the settings called shadow in a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
But yeah. I guess it does more.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's doing it. I don't know. We got to. Yeah, there you go. It's cool stuff found. Thank you, Jason. Good stuff. Cool. Yeah, John. Anything else to report before we move on to the next thing here? All right, cool. I do want to talk about our two sponsors, of course. And our first sponsor is Other World Computing at MacSales.com. This is one of the first places, if not the first place, that John and I go for any kind of upgrade or expansion or really anything that we need to expand and extend the usefulness of our Macs and various computing devices. Their Envoy Pro EX with Thunderbolt 3 is an external drive. You can get it starting in 250 gig capacity up to 1 terabyte. External drive, Thunderbolt 3, rugged portable SSD designed to go anywhere. It's totally bus powered, sustained speeds of up to 1800 megabytes per second. Megabytes per second. That's really fast. Yeah. Yeah. And, it's Thunderbolt 3. So you're going to be able to take advantage of those speeds and it's rugged, right? So it can take it. It's meant to go with you. So you got to check this out. Go to MacSales.com. And when you're checking out, let them know that that we sent you there. They would love to hear that. Our thanks to Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com for sponsoring this episode. Second on the list is Crossover from Codeweavers. You know, these folks have been doing this a long time. They make, it's not virtualization software. It is software that runs Windows software on your Mac without having to run Windows. You don't need to buy a Windows license. You don't need to manage a Windows installation. You get to avoid all the potential of the background malware crap that would run inside of Windows because Windows is not running. Very cool. And the version they just released, now allows support for Quicken 2018 and the latest builds of Microsoft Office. So you can run the Windows versions of these things on your Mac OS or Linux system, if you like, without installing Windows. Now, they know that if you've tried Crossover in the past, it might not have delivered to your standards. They want you to try it again. As we like to say, if you're holding a grudge, it's time to rejudge. So, if you visit them, go to codeweavers.com/MGG, and there you will see a page that welcomes you as a Mac Geek Gab listener and gives you a 14-day free trial and gives you 35% off when you use coupon code MGG at checkout. And it will remind you of that right there on the page. So go check it out. Codeweavers.com/MGG. Try your 14-day free trial, and then you'll be ready to buy. Save 35%. Use coupon code MGG. Our thanks to Codeweavers and Crossover at Codeweavers.com/MGG for sponsoring this episode. Good, good stuff. All right. There's just some more tips, John. I can't help it. I love the tips. Shall we go to them?
Indeed.
All right. Fighting with allergies this morning. Man, it's crazy. Kiwi Graham brings us to an interesting iOS tip. He says, this is either a really short tip or an indication that I've missed a trick somewhere. Well, that's the whole idea behind quick tips. He says, in the iOS Reminders app, there is no gesture that I can find that causes a forcible refresh of its cloudy data. And so I was getting frustrated that it took ages for updates in my iCloud Reminders list to turn up automatically. Then I recalled that previous versions of iCloud panels grouped calendars and reminders together. So I went to the iOS calendar app. I tapped on the calendars button And then I pulled the screen down to have it do one of those little refresh things. And hey, presto, my reminders were also updated. He says, I'm not sure if this is really because both calendars and reminders use the same data store or refresh procedure, or if refreshing my calendar simply caused a refresh of all iCloud data. He says, but it doesn't really matter. It worked. My guess is it's the former, because calendars and reminders are both stored in what's called calendar store on iOS. So my guess is this is just forcing a full refresh of that. But yeah, good little tip. And if anybody knows how to force that refresh from within the reminders view, let us know. That would be a good thing. Cool. Yeah, John. More tips.
I want my stuff up to date, man.
Yeah, man. That's right. But you don't want it burning up the battery when you don't want it. You want it to read your mind. That's the key. Yes. All right. So then, Paul, where is Paul here? I know I'll find it. There it is. Paul says, I thought I'd pass on a tip about what to do to coordinate the same photo library on two different Macs without the use of iCloud Photo Library, which I don't use because I don't entirely trust it. He says, and I also don't like how there aren't any granular controls about how much space iCloud Library uses on my devices, particularly iOS, as opposed to something like Dropbox or Amazon Prime. To replicate the photos library that's on my main MacBook Pro with my Mac Mini, I use a combination of Hazel and Dropbox. He says, I've got a Hazel rule that looks into the masters folder of my MacBook Pro photos library. And when I add something to photos on this Mac, Hazel copies any original files, pics, or movies to a Dropbox folder I've got set up on the MacBook Pro called Photos to Copy to Mac Mini. On the Mac Mini, I have a separate Hazel rule that monitors the photos to copy to Mac Mini Dropbox folder, and if it sees anything in there, it copies the files into my photos library on the Mac Mini. Once the files have been copied, Hazel deletes them from that Dropbox shared folder. It says, I never use both libraries at the same time, so there's no problem there. And this setup also allows me to use Backblaze on my Mac Mini to do an offline backup. On my MacBook Pro, I use Arc to do an encrypted backup to Amazon S3. This is pretty simple, but pretty smart. And then he goes on to say, to make sure I get my wife's pictures of our kids from her iPhone into both of our libraries, I've set up a geofence in the Dropbox app on her phone that automatically uploads her pictures to my Dropbox. I can either suck them straight into my iPhoto library, once again using Hazel, or triage them manually and then put them into my photos library on my MacBook Pro from there. All in all, he says it's a bit of a hack, but it means I can keep two photos libraries in sync on two different machines and have them backed up using different offline services. And all I have to do is chuck pictures into my MacBook Pro's library. The rest now happens automatically. I share this because many of you might be interested in a very similar solution, but it's also just sort of in a general sense, a really good example of how Hazel can do this, and Dropbox too. And you know, the nice part is he's not having to buy storage space on Dropbox because he's just using it essentially for one picture at a time. I mean, maybe a few or whatever, but it's not like he's storing his whole photos library there. It's just the transitory sort of temporary shared storage, and then off he goes. Could use iCloud Drive for this. You could use really any service that shares files amongst your two computers, and it doesn't really matter what it is. If you have a Synology, you could, you know, use Cloud Station or Synology Drive, whatever it's called, Google Drive, doesn't matter. So pretty cool. I like this idea. Very, very cool. Thank you, Paul. Good stuff. Thoughts on this, John?
It's a good hack.
It is a good hack. It's so good it doesn't feel like a hack, right? I mean, it is, but you know, it's a good hack.
What I like is that you avoid, at first I got nervous until I, you know, grokked what's happening here. But I thought what was happening is you're storing your photo library on Dropbox, which I think is something you typically probably don't want to do. Or I think it struggles sometimes with these complex things that are a file but really aren't.
It's right.
Like, you know. But if he's just using it as more a staging area, which it sounds just, like that's...
Yeah, that's it. And he's smart to the trick is navigating in, and this is also where the hack is, but he's got Hazel watching the masters folder inside his photos library. So if Apple were to change the structure of the photos library, then that would start to break down. But that's not going to happen by surprise. We're all going to know that the photo, like Apple's going to have to tell us, yeah, the photos library is changing, or we'll hear about it. So, yeah, it's good stuff. I like it. Thank you, Paul. We talked in, I don't know if it wasn't the last episode, but recently we talked about AppTamer and how it pauses apps and keeps your background processes sort of tame, as per its name. And we sort of speculated as to how it was doing these things. Well, John Gotow and I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, John, I can never remember, St. Clair Soft. I always confuse that with Stairway Software, who makes Keyboard Maestro. But John from St. Clair Software wrote us because he listens to the show. And he said, just to clarify, AppTamer doesn't use the system's nice command because, as you guys pointed out, that doesn't actually cap a process's CPU usage. Nice just gives the process a lower priority, so it'll get less CPU time if there are others competing. It'll make a difference when the machine is getting maxed out or I/O is bottlenecked, but otherwise it doesn't have a huge impact. AppTamer, he says, essentially micro-stops processes. It stops them for small slices of time, then restarts them. You can actually hear this taking place. If you set AppTamer to slow Safari to, say, 5% of the CPU, then start some sort of streaming audio, and then push Safari to the background. Once AppTamer starts throttling Safari, you'll hear the audio stuttering as Safari stops and starts. Depending on how much time an app needs to be throttled, AppTamer may end up giving it very little actual runtime, keeping it stopped most of the time. He says you can also set a process's priority in AppTamer, which does use the nice command or the same Unix underpinnings as nice, by option clicking on a process in AppTamer's process list. The popover window that pops up will then have a priority slider as well as the normal controls, so you can experiment with process priority if you like. I love that he built in the option click to give more, you know, geekier details into the app. But it's funny, I got this email, I queued it up for the show. And then the other day, I was on my MacBook Air doing something, and I had a video running, and I, you know, switched to another app, and I heard it, the video stuttering, and I was like, oh, I know why that's happening. Because I've done exactly this. I've set Safari to be that way in AppTamer. So thank you, John. Very good stuff. Cool. Any thoughts on this, John, before we move on?
I haven't had a need to use their software. You seem to like it.
Oh, it's awesome.
I just don't stress my computer out as, or I don't tax the resources of my computer as
Right. I probably should be using it here in the studio for the podcasting machine here. I find, and I think I mentioned this when we first talked about it, but I find that if I have mail running, and it only took me almost 13 years to figure this out, so, you know, it's all good. But if I have mail running in the background, it will surface more opportunities for audio stutters than if I do not have mail running. And I think it's because, you know, mail goes and checks in the background, it pulls down mail, then it fires off the Spotlight indexing processes and all of that stuff. So if I just tell it to, really what I would do is just tell it to sleep mail if it's in the background. And based on the way I use this computer, that would actually work out just fine. Then I could have mail running potentially while I podcast, whereas now I just quit it. So,
yeah. And don't forget the becoming unresponsive for no good reason at all part. That's the part I like about mail.
I don't have that problem often. Do you have a thought about why that's happening for you?
All I know is when it does, I force quit.
Huh?
You know, I'll click on the icon and it's... comes up, and you know, I get like a spinning, you know, the spinning whatever of wait, please.
yeah, right.
Huh. No, every now and then, I don't know what. So maybe I am having process issues.
That's weird, though. I mean,
it doesn't happen often, but happens every couple of weeks.
Or is the,
it's like I go over to mail and it's just dead to me.
So is the CPU like running, I guess, mail using a lot of CPU in these scenarios or no?
No. Last I recall, it looked like some supporting, some other daemon that I think, as you pointed out, you know, lots of things are happening.
Right.
With mail, you know, it's doing indexing and stuff like that.
Huh.
Yeah, I'll check the process, but it was something with a D at the end, so it could have been a supporting process was traumatizing mail. I don't know.
Yeah. What you probably use GPG mail as a plugin. Do you use any others?
I used to have a spam filter, but I think that's the only one.
Okay.
I'm using that and SigPro.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. I use SigPro and I don't have that issue. So, there's no, who knows what causes all these things, but that's sort of the trick is figuring it out. You know, you can also, and I've found developers who have been able to mine this for valuable and helpful information. If you go into Activity Monitor and highlight a process or actually double click a process and in the lower left corner of that window that appears, there is a sample button that will save sort of a snapshot. I don't know if I have the right description or the right explanation of what it does, but it takes a snapshot in time of what that app is doing and all of its processes. And I've had developers look through that and say, oh, I see what's happening here. It's, you know, and on mail, it's this plugin spiraling out of control or, you know, waiting for something or that kind of thing. So who knows? Maybe, you know, pouring through that sample log could help, John. I don't know. Gordon, because this probably happens to more than one listener, I would think. He says, I definitely learned something new while listening to MacGeekGab 705. Thank you for providing a solution for a problem I didn't know I really had. He says, I have a late 2013 MacBook Pro that works like a charm. However, starting about 6 months ago while working on the computer, the screen would go randomly dark. This would happen maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks. I could see no rhyme or reason for the cause. To get the screen back, I simply closed and reopened the lid. Not a big deal and very random, so I never bothered pursuing the cause. Then the light bulb went on while listening to MGG 705 when, John, you mentioned that the MacBook uses magnets to know that the lid is shut, thus putting the machine to sleep. Well, sure enough, he says, that was my issue. The problem began shortly after I purchased a new band for my Apple Watch, a band that, you guessed it, uses magnets in the clasps. I verified that this is the cause for putting my Mac to sleep. It is repeatable 100% of the time. Anytime I move my wrist near that location, for him, it's the left side of the Mac by the headphone jack, the Mac goes to sleep every time. Thanks again for providing a solution to a problem that I wasn't even trying to solve. There you go. Thanks for sharing that, Gordon. I bet that will help someone else either immediately or like you. You know, it might be one of those things where it's like, hey, I heard about this thing once. And really, that's kind of the goal of what, you know, what we do here in the show is just expanding sort of the knowledge and hive mind so that when something does happen, you have it in your head to be like, oh, wait, I've heard about this before. And that can really save you a ton of time. So there you go. Good. Anything, John?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Okay, cool. Andrew has a question. I'm not sure if we have an answer for him, John, but we will go there nonetheless. Andrew says, within the last months, I began receiving a spam text message from an always changing phone number. Because of this fact, it's very difficult to stop this text message from appearing on my devices that I receive my messages on. Furthermore, there doesn't seem to be some kind of spam blocker built into the messages app on the phone and no obvious way to white or blacklist numbers texting or iMessaging me. I noticed there is a name, which incidentally is not mine, that shows up in every text, but blocking this text using some kind of content filter is also not something that I can do on my iPhone. Do you have any tips for blocking undesirable messages? You can blacklist numbers, but that's not going to help when the number is constantly changing. So, man.
Well, you can, most providers, if you forward the message to 7726, what is 7726, you ask? Spam. If enough people report the number, although it's in all likelihood forged, if enough people report it, then the phone company cellular company can blacklist it.
Well, but maybe like that's why they're changing.
It's like
number.
A moving.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Yeah, because people report it, and then it gets shut down.
So you know,
they won't allow it.
If you go on your iPhone to settings and messages, there are two things in here that might be helpful. The first, in the SMS MMS category, is a blocked list, and you can see what's blocked there, and you can also add new things. Now, as we pointed out, that doesn't really help with your specific scenario here, Andrew, but it might help someone else. So I wanted to point this out while we're on the subject. The other thing, and this might help you, Andrew, is that when you look in here, where it is, it just below that, there is a message filtering section. Now, it's not quite as comprehensive as you would like, Andrew, but there is a filter unknown senders option there where you can turn that on. And what that does is it says it turns off notifications for messages from people who are not in your contacts and sorts them into a separate list. So this might give you that sort of whitelisting capability in a sense. So I share that in hopes that maybe it helps to, if it doesn't avoid or eliminate, maybe it helps to reduce some of the frustration from this. So there you go. You want to take us to Zach?
Okay. You know, I had a fun one the other day. My landline actually got a call, and the ID was Apple Retail. I'm like, Yeah, right. Oh, and they left me a message saying my iCloud was compromised, and I better call them immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, they could have designed it to make it not so easy to forge that stuff.
Right.
You know, digital signatures or crypto or something, but it's just annoying that they're so easily compromised.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's too easy. Yeah. All right, taking us to Zach, John?
I think we are. Okay. Well, this is a good one, a blast from the past, at least I think it is. So Zach says, hi, guys. I'm trying to recover M-boxes and the address book from a 5 to 7-year-old iMac. I was able to recover documents and desktop and photos folders, but when I go into the user folder, I cannot find the library folder. I believe this is Yosemite or something of that era. Okay. I thought these files would be in the user library. Doesn't it live in the user folder? I'm starting up the iMac in target mode. I'm viewing the iMac hard drive contents on a 2012 Mac running High Sierra. Any suggestions? Sure. So, number one, as far as I know, Dave, the mail data has, I thought it always lived in the user folder. Maybe it's just in a different spot. It's not in library.
I'm pretty sure it's in library, but it's a good exercise. So take him down this path. Yeah.
So here, normally it's in your home directory, library, mail, and now it's V5.
Right, and it would have been V3.
In the past, it's been V4, V3, V2. Yeah. Here's what I do, Dave. So you want to find an MBOX file? Why don't we search for it? But it gets a little tricky.
Okay.
So what I do, Dave, is I would use the Finder's Find feature, which when you're in the Finder, you hit Command F, and then you get a search dialog. But you got to do one special thing. These files are considered system files. So what you want to do, we've talked about it in the past, but what you want to do is in the search criteria, you want to enable the system files option and say system files are included. And once you do that, you then say, you then search for the mbox files, and at least on my system, there were tons of them. Now you do is you click on one of them and say get info, and you will get the path to where your mbox files are.
Or right-click on it and say show in enclosing folder.
Ah, yes.
Right, and then that'll get you there.
Yeah.
And I will point out that that will not necessarily show you the hierarchy because it just the Finder just lists that it is mail. So another keyboard shortcut trick that will help you here is when you get to that area where you say show in enclosing folder, command and up arrow will bring you to the enclosing folder of that, and then you can go command and up arrow again to go to the enclosing until you figure out, oh, here's where I am. My guess is, and this will work, right? And mbox dot mbox is a very old non-Apple sort of standard format for storing mail messages, and so that's why. That's why Zach was looking for these, because he knows that it stores them in that format and names them that way. I think the reason Zach's not seeing the library folder, though, is because High Sierra is hiding it from him. Right? The library folder is hidden inside your user folder, but you can force it to be shown by doing our new favorite, I think... This will work for this. If you do command shift period in the Finder, it toggles the view of hidden files on and off. So that might help you dig in and find this stuff too, Zach. And it's a Finder wide toggle. It's not not Windows specific. So if you're doing this like you are, it sounds like on a you know, a client's computer, a friend or family member's computer, you want to make sure to turn that off so that they're not looking in the Finder and seeing all these hidden files that they're not used to seeing. But it's just command shift period that can do that either way, which is super, super handy. There you go.
As for the other item, the context data, that I believe has always lived in your user directory, library, assuming you can find it.
Yep.
This is where it gets tricky. Application support, and then a folder called address book. So even though it's now called contacts in the bowels of the OS, it's still referred to as address book.
Right. Oh yeah.
Now if you don't have that directory, then you can do the same trick to do a search and address book. Now check this out. Those files have a different suffix, and it's ABCDDB, and I bet you that stands for address book card database or something like that.
Wow.
Right?
I bet you're right. Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if you copy that folder from the old machine to the new machine, it's going to populate the it's going to populate the contacts on the new machine that you want to bring it over to.
Huh.
If that doesn't work, then what I do is boot the old machine, if you can, I'm assuming you can, and go into the go into the app and export the data to something like a vCard or whatever, and
then
import it on the new machine.
Yep.
For most apps, including mail and I'm hoping contacts, if you copy the data folder over, most of the time the receiving Mac will be happy with that, right?
It should be in most of the time. Yes.
I've never done a manual contacts migration though.
It's true. I've always done a backup and then a restore, and that way it's backed up in vCard format and comes in that way. But I think that would work. I think. There's one way to find out. Yeah, exactly. That's how we learn these things, right? Is you think, hey, that might work, and then you try it and sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. And now you've learned. Yeah, cool. Where are we on time here? Oh, we got a little bit more time. Okay, good. Yeah, so Paul, thank you for this next one. So Paul said, we were talking in the last show, and I mentioned that my frustration with Siri on my phone, where I said, take me home, and it stopped and said, you have to unlock your iPhone first, which I thought, oh man, that's not the point. And so Paul said, maybe instead of saying, take me home, say, navigate home. And maybe that would do it. And I tried that, and the exact same thing happened. So it was interpreting them both correctly to be, you know, the same thing. But that got me digging. And I'm like, wait a minute. But I did it while I was at my desk. And so I could, because I use an iPhone 10, I looked at my phone and it unlocked after it said you need to unlock your phone first. And then it showed me the answer, because it said, pick which home address you want me to take you to. So evidently I had two home addresses in my contacts record. Now, one of them was just my city and state. I think it got imported from a Facebook data dump or something at some point, but it had it listed as home of the address type. And I suppose from a security standpoint, Apple has decided that it's not going to divulge your address. It's simply going to direct the person that has your phone to your address. Now, one could argue that, you know, doesn't really matter either way, but that's what Apple's decided. So it's not going to display your address on the screen without you unlocking the phone. As soon as I went into my contact record, of course, and cleaned that up and took that out, now it does not ask me to unlock my phone to do that. This is very similar to what was happening when I told it to call my son, and it said, I'm sorry, you have to unlock your iPhone first. And it was because from years ago, when we traveled to Europe, we all got UK-based SIM cards. And so I still had his European number, his UK-based number, in his contact record. Of course, that number's dead now, so it's irrelevant. So I deleted that, and now it would let me call him. So it's an interesting security sort of where that line has been drawn of, yes, you're allowed to make phone calls to people. You're allowed to navigate to your home, but it will not show you the information that it's using to either make that phone call or get those directions without your phone being unlocked. So that there you go. That's where the line's drawn. So thank you, Paul, for the nudge to figure that out. So good stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm looking, seeing what we've got here. I don't know. Let's jump to Davey Dave. I think this is a good one. He says, I have one that's a head scratcher for me. And he says, the lack of the hair on top of my head, given that I'm going to need some help. He said, I want to paint a little picture. He says, I had a teacher drop me an email stating that she cannot find screenshots that she just created. They normally show up on the desktop of her MacBook Pro running 10.13. The past couple of days, she would do a screenshot and nothing would show up on the desktop. He says, I witnessed this while working with her, so I did a spotlight search for the screenshots, and they showed up in the search window. Okay, cool. So I next look at the file's path, and sure enough, it's on the desktop folder. He says, wait, it gets even better. One click on the file in the spotlight search window, and the screenshot all of a sudden shows up on the desktop. We both looked at each other with an I can't believe what I just saw look on our faces. He says, the only troubleshooting I could do at the time was to ask her to restart her laptop before class gets back into the room, not knowing whether or not this solved the issue. He says, I'm going to go back and check it out. And he says, I visited the teacher again this morning, and she told me the restart did the trick. The screenshots all showed up on the desktop, but her wallpaper went away and instead is the default High Sierra wallpaper screen. So to her, life is okay, but now I'm wondering why the desktop wallpaper went away. So the first thing is that Macs get wonky when they haven't been rebooted for a while. We've talked about that, you know, and for me, I find once a week is actually where I want to restart. Less than that, and it doesn't matter if I wait more than a week and things start getting weird. But this is weirder than that. But it's possible that force quitting the Finder may also have solved this. It's possible that force quitting the dock may also have solved this, because I think it's the dock that manages the background pictures, if memory serves.
I'm glad you went there, because that's where I was going to go.
Okay. Yeah.
Even though it sounds kind of counter. Yeah. And the way you do that, of course, is you go into the terminal and you say kill all space dock.
That's the best way. I agree.
And that restarts the dock process.
Yeah.
And may restore some other things.
And may. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like things may suddenly appear. I've had weirdness too. Like, I should have run that. No, I had it where I had a network volume where it wasn't mounted, but it showed it as mounted in the sidebar and I had an eject. And I'm like, well, you're kind of confused, aren't you?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to take a minute here and thank all of our premium subscribers that have contributed this week. And I apologize for not doing this earlier in the episode. When I build the agenda, I put this in and I built the agenda very quickly last night. It's been a crazy weekend. I've been playing drums in my daughter's high school production of Grease. And so my schedule's been a little bit compressed this week. And then, of course, tomorrow's Memorial Day, or today, the day the show's released, is Memorial Day. So we're recording a day early. In any event, I want to thank you. So on the monthly $10 plan at MacGeekGab.com/premium, this week we got contributions from Clive S., Ev the Nerd, Dave G., Jeff F., Joseph B.P., John B., and Tony Z., and in the biannual $25 every 6 month plan, Patrick C., Andrew D., Monroe R., Stephen S., Stephen B., no relation, Paul C. Thank you to all of you. You rock, and we really appreciate it. It's absolutely wonderful that we get to do what we do, and it means your contributions, certainly on the premium side from financially, but really everyone's contributions in every way helps us all, and certainly is inspiring and a driving force for John and me here to just keep doing what we do for all of us. I was going to say for you, but really we do it for all of us. We're included. We are just one big happy Mac Geek Gab family is what it is. So it's good stuff, but now I must go play Grease again, John. So there
Grease
you go.
Is the word.
One last time. That's right. Yeah, it's been fun. It's been good. The last time I did Grease, last time I played the drums for Grease, I was a junior in high school. So I joke with my daughter that I don't have to be one of those theater parents that vicariously relives their high school experiences through their kid. I just get to relive my high school experience there alongside my kid. So it's been pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what we got. I want to, we've told you how to reach us. Our premium subscribers, of course, you can use one of the perks you get is premium at MacGeekGab.com as an email address, and we prioritize the stuff that comes in there. So you can also call us 224-888-GEEK. John, geek is?
4335.
And find us on Twitter. We love talking to you folks on Twitter. At twitter.com/MacGeekGab for the show, twitter.com/JohnFBraun for him, /Dave Hamilton for me, /PilotPete for that guy that sometimes shows up and helps us with real-time feedback during the show. And, yeah, it's good stuff. We'd love for you to follow us there. It's always good. It's always good. I will be in San Jose for WWDC next week. And so I think we're going to record our show while I'm out there. So that should be interesting to make sure that works. I do want to thank all of our WWDC sponsors that are helping us, with all the coverage and everything that we'll be doing. I knew it. I knew I was going to miss the mute button on one of those. Allergies have been awful here in New England. Our WWDC sponsors include iMazing, Carbon Copy Cloner, Jamf Now, Smile, and Eero. So thanks to all of them for really helping us do what we do. Thanks to our sponsors for this episode here. Of course, that was Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com and Crossover from Code Weavers at CodeWeavers.com/MGG. And then, of course, thanks to all of our ongoing sponsors like Smile. So Smile's all over the place with us here. Barebones Software. And we've got a couple more coming on board that I can't wait to tell you about. Ring, actually, of course, ring.com/MGG. Very, very good stuff. Really good stuff, in fact. Thanks so much for listening, folks. Can't wait to do this again next week. John, do you have any thoughts, musings, three particular words?
Well, I know how the TSA loves you.
They do.
And you love them.
I do.
So the only advice I want to give you is that when you are flying and going through security checkpoints, you don't get caught.
Made on a map.